Okay, great. We're going to go ahead and get started. For the beginning of class today, we have a guest speaker, which I'm really excited about. Professor Elliot Bamba is here from the Department of Religious Studies. He is an expert in African religions, and he's currently working on a book about HIV/AIDS titled Facing a Pandemic, Theological Obligations at a Time of Illness. And so he's going to talk today about the socio-political crisis in Africa, the church, and the impact of all this on the globalization of healthcare technology. So let me pull the slides up, and I'm going to turn it over to him.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Good morning. I was trying to make the slides a little fancy, but then I realized I cannot do it, so I gave up. You'll just be satisfied with this one little picture on there. And things have changed a little bit. I think I'm going to say less of the kind of theological questions that I am interested in than just to highlight what is becoming, I think, a greater concern for me, and not from the point of view of an expert, but as somebody who probably can only say that I think religious communities ought to join this debate. And I think it'll become clear as we go when you see what I have to say. In the 1970s, I think it was, the World Health Organization came up with this big, huge thing, Health for All, by the year 2000. Many diseases have not ended. Malaria remains a huge scourge. Then, of course, HIV/AIDS. So by 2000, one could almost say, were it not really a very serious thing, one could almost say by 2000 we had death for all, not health for all. I mean, at least in terms of the region from which I come from, which is Africa. This is UNAIDS Chad, and you can see the divisions there. The heavily, you know, red area reflects where HIV/AIDS has hit the most. And from 1981 or so, when the initial studies and discussion of HIV/AIDS came out, I think it's safe to say, at least for that region of the world, it has gone up. Death has increased. The number of infections have increased. So much so that when you read reports about advances and strategies to stem the pandemic in Uganda, you still have to realize that today, nearly 27 million Africans live with HIV/AIDS. And I think I'm not trying to be a pessimist, but there's also a certain realism to this, that in the last 20-some years, HIV/AIDS has increased and become very deadly. So these are the global figures, about 40 million, two-thirds of them in Africa, which has only 10% of the world's people. More than half of that number, women and children, left millions orphans. It's affected nearly every community. I mean, I think the economic impact of HIV/AIDS is incalculable now. In terms of loss of income, loss of what in the last 15 years both UN development agencies and the World Bank and International Monetary Fund have been touting around us building human capacity, I think all of that has been devastated to a great deal. And so it has been curtailed significantly. Very few people are on any kind of treatment. I think somewhere just below that I talk about the three by five program of the World Health and UN AIDS, which actually failed miserably. I think the only ones that I have heard who have had the courage actually to attack it was the United Nations Secretary General's Special Representative for HIV/AIDS in Africa, Ambassador Stephen Lewis, who actually called it a ludicrous plan, because you have 40 million people living with HIV/AIDS around the world, and the modest goal was to put 3 million people on antiretroviral drugs by 2005. And again, it speaks for itself. It failed. And because it failed, then both the joint United Nations programs for HIV/AIDS and all the organizations that participated in it have decided to go back to what is being touted now as, you know, universal access to health care for everybody. Going back to the whole notion that you cannot solve HIV/AIDS out of, you know, just by itself. It has to take place in a global, comprehensive health care system. But there are other things. Malaria remains a scourge in the region, tuberculosis, and then, of course, HIV/AIDS. The first two have now become largely part of what is called opportunistic infections. And so when you talk of malaria and tuberculosis, you're probably really talking about HIV/AIDS. So why the church? I'm trained in philosophy of religion and theology, so I do research and write in that area. But I think there are much more practical reasons for me. There are many, many more practical reasons for me, I should say. One could almost take any other religious community. I take the church in Africa because that's what I know best, and I do research on that. And this is really from Dunga Kiti, from one of the faith-based organizations that is working in Africa. The church can serve as an advocate for many, many people. They have access to a wide audience. I think there is no community in Africa that has the hold on people that religious communities do. And they can bring a holistic approach. We can talk about that. That's debatable, but I think this is what he claims. I think it's possible, but it's not always the case. And then they have the infrastructure, which is, you know, it would be infrastructure that you would find in at a level where you would find a lot of infrastructure in the developing countries, which is really not what is comparable to what you have in the medical center, but it's actually much better than what the state has to offer. I can speak more directly about Cameroon. If you were in Cameroon today, apart from the very expensive private clinics, probably the best place to get any kind of good health would be at a church clinic. They have the infrastructure, they have the integrity, and they have a good track record. There were some things that he had there that I have taken out. Of course, it reflected a much more evangelical Christian approach to that. And so I took that out. But I think of a greater concern for me has been research on HIV/AIDS. Most of the researchers live in the West. There's some work being done in Africa. Some collaborate with African institutions. The Centers for Disease Control is starting a study in Mutengeni in the southwest province of Cameroon. I don't know the extent of the work. When I was in Cameroon in January, I could not get in there to see them. It was a holiday, so they were closed. But I talked extensively with the director of the health board of the Cameroon Baptist Convention that is renting that facility to the Centers for Disease Control. And he said, you know, I do not know exactly what they will do. They're still setting up. But it will involve research into medicinal plants and so forth. So they are using that facility. It used to be called Planticam, owned by a French consortium which manufactured drugs locally. The Baptist Health Board also hopes that they can get to a point where they can carry out that kind of research. But for now, they use it to manufacture local IVs. This sort of research is still in its infancy. When I was there, actually, the main machine that is used to do all of their operations was broken down. And they had to send it over to Germany, and it was going to take at least 2 or 3 months before they got their equipment back. And so you can see some of the problems with infrastructure that one gets into when you talk of the developing world. Yes. CDC, Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. CBC is a Cameroon Baptist Convention. I'm sorry. Below that, there's a note about one Cameroonian scientist, Victor Nomangu, who has carried research for many years in Yaoundé. Several years ago, he claimed that he had actually discovered a vaccine that could be used against HIV/AIDS. Of course, it was very controversial. To date, I think I hate to say credible, because when I say credible scientific organization, then I am almost taking sides against him in a debate that I am not qualified to pass judgment on. But I think, take that with a grain of salt, you would understand what I mean, that no major scientific organization has endorsed his research, nor has his treatment been approved by the Cameroon government. But he continues to labor, and he thinks that he is onto something that could actually be a major breakthrough in HIV/AIDS research. I think one of my concerns, and I developed this in a conversation in South Africa last fall, it turned out to be more controversial than I thought, because people thought I was bringing back 19th century concepts. But I think the private voluntary organizations and the faith-based organizations who work predominantly in palliative care ought to expand their work and get into basic medical research. We have no time, but I could flesh out the proposal. What I mean basically is this. If if churches or faith-based organizations and religious institutions are going to expect young people like yourself who get a good education, go to medical school, get an MD, PhD, and you are godly people or religious people, whether a Muslim or Hindu, whatever tradition, and then they send you overseas, and you spend the whole time taking care of people, I think that is good, but to a certain extent, it may be a waste of resources, because there is a lot of talent now that could go into direct medical research in developing countries, rather than have a team of specialists go for 1 month, set up, and when they go overseas for 1 month and set up, it's really big time. You need to see the places where they go. It's like the U.S. Army has invaded some place and taken over. They do what they're supposed to do, pay the people. There's a lot of employment. A lot of work is generated. Everybody is in high gear. And when the project is done, maybe a month, 6 months later, they all pack up, leave, and return to the West, where they continue to carry on the work on the specimens or whatever they have collected in that country. But I think Those who work in private networks, religious organizations, who go for a much longer time, if a select few of them are prepared to continue to do that kind of research on a regular basis, it might be a step forward, a real step forward. Because right now, there are very few places, maybe South Africa, Kenya, some in Cameroon, where people are beginning to do actual basic research with the aim of developing new forms of therapies. And if religious groups can join that march, I think it's going to help move their work forward. The tension here always, of course, is the work of religious groups is not really to do research. They're out to, you know, to save souls. They're out to do that. I think they have to change their theological outlook and adopt an outlook that sees the kind of service that is rendered to human beings, especially at this time of need, as something much more valuable. Well, much more valuable than soul winning. If you ask me, I probably will say yes. I probably would say yes, because in a situation where 27 million people, if there is nothing comes on the horizon, 27 million people are likely going to die in the next 10 years. I think it's actually hypocritical for religious groups to spend time doing soul winning when all of those people are dying. So it's going to call for a major, major shift in orientation, and I'm not ignorant or being foolish. I assume that it's going to take a lot of fights, a lot of battles, and major, major shift in resources before something like this can happen. But I think that's an ideal that they should shoot for. So, in order to do that, then we get into the question of technology. If you have traveled in the developing world at all, you know what these are, and this is really not my idea. It comes from Eyitayo Lambo, who is the health minister of Nigeria. Technology is needed to build an infrastructure, and we are not only talking of any kind of technology, but new technology that would make it possible for researchers to go between, you know, all research centers around the world and have no difficulty. And from his own perspective, he talks of technologies that is needed to accomplish all of the things he has needed there. But, you know, we'll move forward with the idea that a technology is needed. And then again, these are his arguments. I am interested especially in the second area, and that is where I have just begun to do a lot of reading. And that is the area of developing vaccines. He talks about the ones that would be used to eradicate diseases, ones that would reduce prevalence of other diseases. And then, of course, malaria, HIV/AIDS, and I think ST is really STD, several sexually transmitted diseases. There is really nothing on the market now to help combat those things. And the development of an infrastructure, research infrastructure that could begin to address that on location in Africa, I think would be a step forward. This is not, you know, I'm not saying get Westerners out, let Africans do the job. No, that's not what I mean. I mean set research facilities in such a way that people can go back and forth and collaborate together. It makes it actually much easier for people both in Africa and here to be able to work together. Then one of the things that when you talk about technology that always comes up is the idea of technology transfer. Idea being what is available elsewhere should be transferred to Africa. And that assumes that it can be transferred easily. And the problem is just that the infrastructure might not be there to be transferred. And so what is needed, I think, first of all, is a commitment to a culture of science and industry in Africa, which is actually quite lacking in many countries. There's a quote there from Ghanaian philosopher Kwame Jachi, Africa will have to participate significantly in the cultivation and promotion of science and technology if it is to benefit from it fully. But the extensive and sustained understanding and acquisition of modern technology insistently require adequate cultivation of science and the scientific outlook. This is something that has suffered greatly during the decline of the post-colonial state. If you look at many, many universities in Africa, outside of South Africa, maybe outside of Egypt, with the exception of Kenya and Nigeria, and then Ghana to a certain extent, a lot of universities have taken a big hit simply because the post-colonial state has declined significantly, something which did not happen overnight. By the late 1970s, it was very clear to African heads of states that the economy had declined significantly, and many of the countries could not function on their own. And so they met in Lagos, came up with what was called the Lagos Plan of Action, which, among other things, projected very aggressive approaches to science and technology. But it did not really happen that easily. The World Bank was not very pleased with their plan because it left out the private sector. And so by late 1979, the World Bank and the IMF appointed a commission to study the whole thing, headed by Professor Elliot Berg. When the Berg Report was issued in 1980, it became the yardstick that was used to promote structural adjustment in Africa. And of course, there's a long debate here, something that structural economic reforms and adjustments actually set back many, many African countries. And, you know, my point here is I think what suffered as a result was not just that economic subsistence declined significantly, but in the process, universities and programs that trained people in science and industry took a very, very, very big hit. Many African states have not really recovered from that. And so to talk about building the new kinds of health technologies that will enable researchers do work that is needed today calls for a really, really big change. There's a considerable amount of progress on that in Africa. They have set up a science and technology group, which is supervised by the Council of Ministers of the Africa Union. There's several websites that deal with that whole thing, and this is just one of them. Now, people continue to talk in Africa about alternative therapies and herbal healing. I think those have their place. They have served for thousands of years. But however, I mean, and this is my position, we are dealing with something baffling when you talk of HIV/AIDS, something that remains mysterious. Modern technology has enabled scientists to diagnose it, map out the different ways the virus is replicating. And I just think that we ought to pursue technology and work with alternative therapies because technology might be the key to making those alternative therapies work. This is not either or I am not saying throw out the ancient traditions of herbal healing. Many of you know that that tradition is probably even stronger in older civilizations like China than some of the newer countries in Africa. But the argument here is, I think, we are confronted with something that is rather new, something that scientists are able to at least map it out and predict with a certain degree of accuracy how this thing is evolving and how it is killing many, many people. So I think those who work in herbal treatment might actually ultimately benefit if technology is developed. I think the real question here is, can technology be used to enhance what is done in alternative healing? Or will technology be used to totalize, to take over what people who work in alternative healing are doing? If that is the case, then that's when, you know, there are problems. But if they work as partners together, I think it will enable the human community make progress. So it calls for a lot of things: basic infrastructure, electricity, water, roads. Some of the places where, if we take, for instance, the model of going through faith-based organizations or private voluntary organizations, there will be a lot of investments in those places, in, you know, telephone, communications practices, computers. The health board, as I have said, is working with the Centers for Disease Control, but they recently acquired a large grant from the United States Agency for International Development. And when I was there in January, the director was telling me that they had ordered a large, some new equipment that would enable them create an email system that can service all of the countries in the region that they're working with. But it turned out that his missionary friend who bought it from a Nigerian dealer who lives here in the United States. I almost hesitate to say the guy lives here in Houston, but it turns out it was not working. The thing did not work. And so when he tried to call that number and get back to the dealer, he couldn't get the person. And so the director, when I was in there, I mean, he called him. I had to just leave the office, but he had to tell him, no, I want you to scrap this deal, buy something that works. If they cannot refund the money, that is fine. We will take the hit. We cannot be dealing with USAID and then doing this kind of thing. And it highlights, I think, the problems they are going to have in setting up infrastructure. It's a very, very difficult problem. Some areas have electricity, some areas don't, and they're just going to have to work. And then they are going to install new scientific, you know, and medical equipment. But I think something that I want to touch on and take a few minutes and talk about is, again, an area that is quite new to me, but I think I am convinced is something that should be explored. This has to do with biotechnology. Great interest in that area, especially because of food. HIV/AIDS is taking away the productive generation. Drought is still a problem in many, many, many countries in the region. And food needs will grow. It's estimated that the population of the world will double by 2046. And so biotechnology, especially things that deal with medical and plant technology, has raised a lot of issues. From a religious perspective, this is a problem or an issue that needs to be discussed. And here I highlight only the Protestants. Way back in 1973, the World Council of Churches started consultation on new technologies that were emerging at that time and raising severe ethical questions if this was the way to go. I have a list there, and I think Rebecca is going to put it on the website, and then you can look at it and look at it much more detailedly. Then, of course, there's the Catholic side of the debate. Actually, the Catholic ethicists and philosophers and theologians have more to say on this subject than maybe all of the other Christian denominations control. And in 1990, the Catholic Health Association issued a document, Human Genetics, Ethical Issues in Genetic Testing, Counseling, and Therapy. But you can read also lots of things that they have had to say about the use of biotechnology. In post-apartheid South Africa, where biotechnology has actually taken root, there's very active research going on there. People have raised questions about environmental racism and justice and so forth. Now, what I mean by this, these two last slides, is that even though what I know from preliminary research actually makes me think that for the region of Africa, in the light of the devastation that is taking place, biotechnology, the use of biotechnology, even genetically modified organisms and so forth, and food, might be the way to go, or should be the way to go. We are dealing with something that is very controversial, and people talk about it. I mean, campaign against it has been led by NGOs, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth. They highlight the danger to biodiversity because of the release of transgenic materials. And they, of course, raise caution about genetically modified organisms. These concerns should be addressed. I mean, if you look at what has happened in the international discussions, for instance, the UN Convention on Biological Diversity of 1992, which was part of the Rio process, was intended to establish a set of protocols that would address the regulation of the displacement of living modified organisms that may have negative effects on the environment. But even here, I think it is still an open debate, an open conversation, because people still oppose it very, very strongly. In Africa, Wangari Maathai has given her blessings. Oh, you all know Wangari Maathai, who won the Nobel Prize for environmental activism in Kenya. She has given her blessings to biotechnology and argued that it is here to stay. What African states need to do is to train people to minimize the risk involved, and this can be done by implementing biosafety laws. And this is an important endorsement, because throughout her life she has planted trees in Kenya and just helped make the environmental movement alive in Kenya. But if you also look at the reality, you know that food is a major, major, major issue, and biotechnology might actually hold the key to solving some of those problems. The African Union has set up a biotechnology advisory panel. It did so last year, and they have been working hard. And then, of course, it's a quote. It's always safe to quote Jimmy Carter on these things. I don't know if it actually affects what happens in the lab, but he's a nice guy to quote. And so we have that quote from him. One of the things I have been doing is looking at responsibility of African governments. And I haven't done very much work on this, but this is just really a sketch. The other things that I have worked on are obligations in trying to reform a failed political state. The dialectics of transformation in Africa is about that kind of engagement. And I have been doing some writing on what the state needs to do in light of HIV/AIDS. But in terms of the kinds of things that we are talking about this morning, I think African governments need to continue to promote a culture of science and research. I have no qualms saying that I don't have any conflict in my mind about religion and science. I think those who continue to fight that battle have really missed the boat. When I buy a new computer, I just use it and start to work. It really doesn't matter to me if the person who manufactured it, what they thought of Darwin or what they thought of, what they think of God. I mean, I think the realities of science and the things that we can do do not really alter faith or anything. I think failure to continue to promote a rigorous culture of scientific research in Africa might leave that region of the world in difficulties. I think science is part of the human experience that should be used, particularly during these difficult days, to work to change the human situation. They should invest in science and technology, improve rural areas, collaborate with private voluntary organizations and faith-based organizations. But I also think they need to promote a democratic culture, because I think science and research would thrive in a democratic culture where people are allowed to go and come and people are not hassled, where professors and researchers do not have to struggle so hard before they go to a conference or before they organize one or before they write a paper. It's an enormous issue for young researchers working in some places in Africa. And then, of course, address the brain drain. That's a whole new issue where there is a lot of debate. There are some who think that it's actually the Western industrialized nations who are guilty for absorbing all of the bright and best and brightest from the developing world into the economies of North America, Western Europe, and Australia and New Zealand. It's debatable. I think most of us from that part of the world who are elsewhere in the world do so for personal reasons. And one of those reasons is just basically the fact that one can do research, one can write, one can work without having a policeman knock on your office and ask you questions or take your computer to examine. I mean, except if you're working in a nuclear lab at Los Alamos, something like that may happen, or you're working for the CIA at some place, those things happen. So you find those things everywhere. But I think the brain drain is a large issue which involves basic immigration questions of pull factors and the ones that push people away that one cannot just simply moralize and say this country is using its money to attract the best and brightest from another place in the world. Thank you. I think I'm done. I don't know if I said anything, but I think it tells you the kinds of things I'm interested in, especially the next 2 years I will spend some time reading more about biotechnology to find out what it can contribute to food development and production in Africa. Thanks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think so. It's a good point. I just wanted to give you a large figure. But I agree with you. I think if we don't want to give people the impression that everyone in Africa has AIDS. 4 years ago, I was working with a Rice student on a study abroad. And when I mentioned some African countries, she flatly told me, no, I don't want to go to Africa. I'm going to get AIDS. And then I said, well, you can get AIDS here in Houston. So I think you're very correct. We don't want to give the impression that this is a... If it were a longer talk, I think one can go into statistics, breakdown into, countries, age groups, income levels, and so forth. But still, I think we also need to raise the question that there are 27 million people living with HIV/AIDS. And then we can also say why. I don't think that has happened because Africans have sex any more than you guys do. I really think that it has happened because of a long neglect. When HIV/AIDS started in 81, African governments just sort of laughed, said, no. In fact, you used to hear very important members of government say, something is going to come from America and destroy everybody. Because at that point, it was sort of, people thought it was restricted to the gay community, which was not the case. And then when they realized, by the time that they realized, it had actually entered the general population. And most of them set up their first AIDS committees, National AIDS Committee, only in 1990. So that's why it has taken such a devastating turn. But you are exactly right. Yeah.
I would like to have one more question. Mm-hmm. I know Uganda had a very effective anti-poverty campaign.
mm-hmm. where they sort of just made it like more of a display, I want to say, than no, not that, but that was a must have item.
Mm-hmm. No, not as successfully as in Uganda, because for some reason it has also become very controversial for the church. In as much as I think the religious communities can do a lot of good, I must be honest with you and think that religious communities have done evil, great evil. I think this whole campaign against the use of condoms has been very deadly. I mean, even Uganda, President Museveni, who was actually quite progressive when he spoke at Bangkok at the World AIDS Day, World AIDS Conference almost 2 years ago, he went on a rampage just lambasting everybody, saying people are trying to condomize Africa. You know, you felt like somebody should just shake him and say, look, wake up, stupid. Nobody is condomizing Africa. I mean, the reality is people are sexual beings. And we're talking about science and technology. What is a condom? It's just a device that would prevent fluids from going from one body to another. It doesn't take away the meaning of sex or anything, or it doesn't take away its spiritual or its noble meaning. I think the church has done a lot of harm in Africa. Yeah, and then we'll get to you. There is. There is a split, but also when I talk of faith-based organizations in Africa, it has a very different political climate than it is here in the United States, where there has always been a vigorous campaign to maintain the separation of church and state. What you might see here as a luxury, like attending St. John's or going to some Catholic hospital and so forth, in Africa it's a necessity, because if those institutions were not there, there's no way the government could provide everything. So actually the government usually goes out of its way to work with those organizations, because they provide the best hospitals, they provide almost, you know, more than a third of all the educational institutions in the country. So it's a very different kind of conversation. Even when the churches in Africa as evangelical as the ones here are, but the kind of conversation between what would be called faith-based initiative in this country is very different from what you have in Africa. Yes, sir. At some point, they all did. You all are aware of the ABC program, and that's what worked very effectively in Uganda. However, a year ago, many people, even joined by members of the scientific community, I think I remember one article distinctly in Science News that tried to argue that it was actually abstinence that lowered the rates of infection in Uganda than condoms. But the evidence actually is quite overwhelming that it was increased condom use that lowered the rate of infection. Because studies done by social scientists also showed that during the same period, sexual activity did not decrease. It actually increased, but there was no reason to believe that it had increased because of the availability of condoms. So it's a little tricky, but you know, bottom line for me, if I might use sort of a cliche, is that if you look at it, part of the argument by members of the religious community has been that condoms only work like 50% of the time. If they work 50% of the time, we'll be talking about 14 million people on HIV/AIDS. Now, you don't have to be a mathematician to know that. You know, 14 million is less than 27 million, or it's a much better situation. And I think what I find about a lot of RISE students is that you may not go to church, But many of you are actually quite spiritual people, even people who clearly say they are agnostic. You know, I think I probably have the license here to speak to you as a much older person. Think about it. You know, what's evil in condoms? That it has had, you know, it has had such a real negative spill in Africa. What is it about a product that has been manufactured? You know, all of a sudden we see that as, you know, a weapon of mass destruction or something. And I think this is something that probably young people like yourself who have contacts around the world are just going to have to tell people, whether they argue from a religious perspective. I think it's a real disservice to the people around the world. We can say that about Thailand, we can say that about people in India today who are living with HIV/AIDS, and I think your question was also that we highlight the global perspective. I use Africa as an example because I think that's the area I know a little bit more than other parts of the world. So the ABC worked, but for some reason there are people in churches who always feel guilty if there is something that gives people the impression that people are having sexual intercourse, because they think condoms suggest that. I think it's a big mistake. People are doing it anyway. So I think the church should face up to reality. I'm not saying they should depart from their moral standards. That's a very different statement, a very different conversation. It all hinges on the if somebody makes the decision to. Museveni argued at the World Health Conference that World AIDS Congress in Bangkok that most men are actually drunk when they have sex. Well, maybe they need help with alcoholism. Sorry about that. I mean, I'm a little older than all of you, so I think I can assume the right to speak as an elder who is touched by all of this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, yeah. Thanks.
Have a good day. Okay. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. I thought it was a wonderful talk. I feel so inarticulate now that I have to follow. But I want to tell a really interesting story in the time that we have left today. You'll remember last time we talked about the artificial heart. We talked about sample size calculations and the types of errors that can result in clinical trials. I'm going to skip through this review kind of quickly since we went a little bit over time. And I'm also going to, I'll post this article on the slides. Josh in class sent me a really interesting article about the use of closed heart surgery, laparoscopic heart surgery, to replace heart valves. And it actually ties in really nicely to what I want to talk about today. So if you get a chance, check out this article. It's very interesting. So all semester long, we've been working our way down this arrow. We started out with the science of understanding disease, the engineering design process to develop new technologies, how we test those new technologies in clinical trials. And finally, we're going to get down here to the bottom of the arrow and think about how do technologies go from the laboratory to your physician's office. And in our last unit, in Unit 4, we're going to look at what factors affect the diffusion of technology, and then we're going to look at how we get approval in order to market new technologies, and what's the role of the Food and Drug Administration in this process, and then we'll look at how funding of research happens in our country. And so today what I want to look at is I want to look at the diffusion of technology. And we're going to look at two examples. We're going to look first at the example of vitamin C to prevent a disease called scurvy. And we're going to look at the diffusion of laparoscopic surgery to remove the gallbladder. And I don't think you could pick two more examples where the rates of diffusion were more dramatically different. So let's first look at the use of vitamin C to prevent scurvy. And so here we go back to 1497, when Vasco da Gama was sailing around the Cape of Good Hope and actually had 160 crew members on his ship, and 100 of them died as a result of scurvy. In 1601, a British Navy captain, his name was James Lancaster, and he was in command of four ships that were traveling from England to India. And he did a very interesting experiment. He did a controlled experiment. So on one of his ships, he required sailors to take 3 teaspoons of lemon juice daily, and his other 3 ships served as the control group. So in his experimental group, he had 0 deaths. And in his control group, 110 out of 278 sailors died as a result of scurvy. That is a pretty dramatic difference. So how long do you think it took for this technology to diffuse out? Well, in 1747, almost 150 years later, we repeated the study. A British Navy physician, James Lind, and observed the same kind of dramatically different results. And it wasn't until 1865 that the British Navy finally adopted this innovation. So it took 264 years for this very, very effective and relatively simple technology to diffuse. Now, since then, there have been a number of studies to take a look at what factors affect the rate of diffusion of a technology. This is from an interesting article written by Don Berwick. And what he's done is he's looked at how long it takes people to adopt a new technology and characterized adopters of technology into several groups. And the first people that adopt the technology, and we're going to see an example of this type of person, these people are characterized as innovators. These are the people that drive change. And they're often viewed as weird, as very incautious people, people who are a little bit dangerous and maybe believe the rules don't quite apply to them. They're risk takers, socially disconnected. They're followed by the early adopters. The early adopters are people who are viewed as social opinion leaders. They're viewed as people who are at the leading edge, but not quite out at the front of the leading edge. And then we have what are known as the early majority. They tend to follow. They look to the early adopters. What are they doing? If they're doing it, it must be okay. I'm going to think about adopting it based on their experience. Then you have the late majority. They really want to see, are people in my community having success with this new technology? They won't adopt it until they see local evidence of success. And then you have the laggards. These are the people who are, you know, it was good enough for me 20 years ago. It's good enough for me today. Why do I want to change? And so what we find is we find that there's a tipping point. And the tipping point typically happens somewhere in here, when you've got 15 to 20% of your population who've adopted a new technology, then it tends to disseminate outward. And there's a very interesting book written by Malcolm Gladwell by the same name that talked about this phenomenon associated with many different types of innovations. So I want to take a look at a very interesting case study, and this is the use of laparoscopic techniques to remove the gallbladder. We talked about with heart disease the use of closed chest surgery to do bypass grafting. The article talked about valve replacement. None of those technologies would be possible if it weren't for these first innovations with laparoscopic surgery to remove the gallbladder. So this procedure is called cholecystectomy. That's removal of the gallbladder. So just first a little bit of physiology. So the gallbladder sits underneath the liver here. And the function of the gallbladder is basically to store bile, which is produced in the liver. So the gallbladder stores the bile, and after you eat a meal, then the gallbladder is going to contract, and it's going to secrete bile through the common bile duct into your intestine, and that bile will aid in digestion. What can go wrong is that you can form gallstones, and those gallstones can block the flow of bile out of the bile duct. This is actually a very common problem. A fifth of North Americans, a quarter of Europeans, at some point in their lifetime will develop gallstones. And what happens is if these gallstones block the flow of bile, you get very severe abdominal discomfort, you get pain, heartburn, indigestion, and the most serious problem is you get acute inflammation, and that can lead to rupture of the gallbladder. So how do we treat gallstones? Well, before 1990, what would happen is you would have basically an open abdominal surgery, and the gallbladder would be removed. You can live without your gallbladder. Your liver is still going to produce bile, and so you don't need your gallbladder to survive. So this was an effective procedure to treat this disease. Had a very low mortality rate, 0.3 to 1.5%, but it was still major surgery. It required a week in the hospital. You typically missed a month of work. And it's a very common procedure. In many countries, it's the most common non-obstetric surgical procedure. But it worked pretty well. Now, laparoscopic cholecystectomy today is viewed really as the most significant advance in surgical techniques in the 1980s. This procedure allows a much shorter hospitalization stay. As we'll see, it allows a much more rapid recovery, early return to work, and cost less. All good things. And as we've seen, this technique is really what enabled many more of these minimally invasive surgical procedures to be developed. So what happens in the procedure? Patients still receive general anesthesia, so they're asleep during the procedure, and basically three small incisions are made in the abdominal wall. One is made through the belly button, and two others are made beside that. And so an incision is made at the navel, and a thin tube, which carries a video camera, is inserted through the incision in the navel. The next thing is we're going to make what's called a virtual space in the abdominal cavity. Basically, we're going to blow it up like a balloon with CO2 gas to allow the surgeon's room to manipulate and see the organs inside. And then two other instruments will be inserted through two other holes. Basically, they're like tiny little hands that are going to allow the surgeon to pick up the gallbladder, move the intestines out of the way, and carry out the surgical procedure. So they will place clips on the blood vessels that supply the gallbladder with blood so you don't have internal bleeding, and then safely dissect and remove the gallbladder. The gallbladder is actually pulled out through the hole that's made in the belly button, and the entire procedure takes not very much time, 30 to 60 minutes. The puncture wounds don't require stitches. You can use staples to staple them closed, and they leave just very tiny scars. You can't even see the scar in the belly button. Here's a cartoon of the procedure. This is after insufflating the abdomen with the gas. And so here is the camera that's been inserted through the hole in the belly button. And then here are some of the grippers that are used. I'm going to show you some actual photos on this website. Get connected here. Okay. So here are some photos of a laparoscopic cholecystectomy. Okay, here is the gallbladder. You can see it's very distended. It's full of bile because the bile duct has been blocked. And so they punctured it with a needle. They're going to drain the bile out of the gallbladder so they're able to pull the gallbladder out through the hole and they drain outside of the patient. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So here we are dissecting the cystic duct free. Okay, these are the clips that they're going to place. And then they can cut between the clips. So here's a clip on either side, and there's the cutter to cut. Okay, so they're going to do the same thing to the artery. They use electrocautery to cauterize some of the smaller blood vessels so you don't have bleeding inside. Now the gallbladder is free. They put it in a little plastic bag, and then they're going to pull it out through the hole in the navel. So here they are. Getting ready to pull it out. They're just basically going to clip them off so that they don't bleed and leave them. Okay, so that's the surgical procedure. Has a number of advantages. From the patient's perspective, it is a much easier procedure to recover from. So you don't have a big incision, so you don't have pain associated with the incision. Most patients go home the same day. They don't even have to stay overnight in the hospital. And within a few days, they can resume their normal daily activities, and they're not left with a big scar. The complication rate for this procedure is about the same as the complication rate for the standard open surgical procedure. You might experience a little bit of nausea and vomiting, predominantly associated with the anesthesia. Occasionally, you can injure some of these arteries during the laparoscopic procedure, which generally means you just have to go for an open surgical procedure. And this happens in 5 to 10% of the cases that are attempted laparoscopically. Let me ask you a question. Do you think this procedure diffused slowly or rapidly? It diffused amazingly rapidly. And it happened because of a guy named Kurt Sem, who was a very important innovator in laparoscopic surgery. He died in 2003. He was actually a gynecologist, and he invented more than 80 medical devices, including the electronic insufflator. So you can see one of his patents here for the electronic insufflator. This is the device that fills up the abdominal cavity with the CO2 gas. So we can get it. Yeah, here's the Sem et al. Apparatus for the insufflation of gas. This is the patent, which was awarded in 1987. He invented thermocoagulation devices, the loop ligator to go in and ligate arteries and ducts, techniques for suturing, sewing through the laparoscope. His brother and father owned a medical device company, and so whenever he wanted them to make a prototype for him, he could go and say, this is what I'm thinking about, can you make it for me? And he invented a number of tools that allowed complicated surgeries to be done more simply, both in gynecology but also in general surgery. So this is a guy who's a very inventive and creative person. Endoscopically means basically we're going to do it through a tiny hole via a fiber optic camera. So in 1985, Sem was the one who developed the techniques that allowed the first laparoscopic appendectomy, the removal of the appendix with the same kind of procedure. And at that time, it was said that the big advantage of doing this was it prevented adhesions that can form between internal organs after an open surgical procedure, and they can cause complications later on in life. So what do you think the public response was to this first laparoscopic surgical procedure? They basically said, this guy is nuts. So these are quotes. he has gone absolutely crazy. These are things that people said about Kurt Thumm. He was actually asked to undergo a brain scan by his colleagues because they felt that he might be suffering from a tumor. The lectures that he gave about this procedure, people laughed openly, and they said, too expensive, too dangerous, why would anyone want to do this? They said that he was exaggerating the problems associated with the traditional surgery, putting his patients at risk. And basically, people saw no reason to change a procedure that worked well and that had a low complication rate. Why should we change? We have a perfectly good treatment, and you're asking us to take additional risk. So Sen said both surgeons and gynecologists were angry with me. All of my initial attempts to publish about this were refused. All my papers were rejected with the comment that this is nonsense, it doesn't belong in general surgery, and it never will belong in general surgery. This is in 1985. He was accused of having surgeon envy because he was a gynecologist. And they said he was trying to enter into general surgery just to bolster his operation ego. So given all that, do we still think this technology diffused very rapidly? This is in 1985. People are saying, this guy's crazy. He needs to have a brain scan. He has a mental illness. He has a problem with his self-image. He just wants to, you know, do crazy stuff. Well, if we look, the first laparoscopic cholecystectomy was performed in 1989. So the laparoscopic appendectomy was done in 1985. People said he's crazy, never going to diffuse out. 1989, we did the first laparoscopic cholecystectomy. This graph shows the percentage of gallbladder removals that are performed through the laparoscope. This is 1989, this is 1990, this is 1991, and this is 1992. The VA tends to be a population of elderly, very sick individuals. And so in this VA population, over that 3-year period, we went from 0 to 50%. U.S. healthcare is an HMO, tends to serve a younger, healthier population. In those 3 years, we went from 0 to more than 80% of these procedures being performed through the laparoscope.